You're listening to the Everyday Athlete Podcast, Episode 10, the podcast for everyday athletes everywhere, in association with 97 Display.
Welcome to the Everyday Athlete, the podcast for everyday athletes everywhere. You're now part of an exciting movement of adventurous everyday athletes who want to train smarter and live to 100 years old. Now, here's your host, Josh Kennedy.
Welcome to the Everyday Athlete Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Kennedy, and it's great to make you part of a growing community trying to change the world through health and fitness, who like to train differently, train smarter, and live a healthy and fulfilling lifestyle. If you want to take a step away from the mainstream, this podcast will give you an insight into the daily life of an everyday athlete, and we look forward to you joining us. Thank you so much for tuning in once again. If you're new to the podcast, welcome, welcome, welcome. It is great to have you here. Just a quick announcement before I introduce today's guest. If you haven't seen, we have gone completely digital here at Strength Matters, which means if you haven't already, you do need to get onto the Google Play or App Store and download our Strength Matters app, where you can indeed access all of the editions of our Strength Matters magazine, as well as our podcasts, blogs, and Whiteboard Wednesdays. Right, on to today's guest. It's my absolute pleasure to have Kate Solo, which isn't her full name, by the way, but don't worry, I do attempt to pronounce it when I introduce her. My first female guest on the podcast, she is an absolute awesome inspiration to everyone, not just females, but to everyone, I think. We talk all about obstacle course racing. We talk about her work as a nutritionist and lifestyle coach with Precision Nutrition. We talk about her motivational interviewing. We talk about her training regime. We talk all about her epic bucket list, which I have to say is amazing, and I think everyone can take a few tips from that, and absolutely tons more. I'm going to stop babbling. Here's Kate. My guest today is, well, pretty much awesome, and she has, I have to say, the coolest nickname. She is a blogger, extreme endurance runner, traveler, health coach with Precision Nutrition. She's been blogging about the sport of obstacle course racing, or OCR, nutrition, health, and travel since around 2012. Originally from Russia, born in Siberia, she emigrated to Canada as a teenager. She has an undergraduate and graduate degrees in psychology. She loves all things human behavior and coffee. She's been a student, a professor, a yoga teacher, a boot camp instructor, and has a bucket list which is about as long as the border with the United States. Not only that, as I said, she does have the coolest nickname, which is Solo. Please welcome to the Everyday Athlete Podcast, Ekaterina Soloviova, also known as Kate Solo, or I think I might just call you Princess Leia, because Princess Leia was a badass, and so are you. Kate, welcome to the Everyday Athlete Podcast. Fantastic to have you here.
Thanks so much. Holy moly, I'm listening to that list, and I'm a little tired, to be honest. Thank you. That was a great intro, and read in the most adorable accent.
So thank you so much. You're so sweet. Not that you had any idea where I was from until 5 minutes ago.
That is true. I had to ask. Yeah, I'm notoriously bad with accents, having one of my own. So,
although I have to say, you know, you don't have even a hint of Russian accent at all.
Not Russian, but you're going to have to kind of poke me when you hear it come through, because I think there are certain words that still give me away. So sometimes when I chat with someone for like 10, 15 minutes, they're like, oh my God, you're not from around here. So you'll have to tell me when you hear it.
It's interesting. You know, there's a bit of, you can tell you're probably not Canadian. It's a bit like, it's a bit of a mishmash. I like it. It's good.
Mishmash is a good word to describe me, probably, in general.
Right, fantastic. So we are a little bit pressed for time today, so we're going to crack straight on. Kate, if you could just introduce yourself, give us a little bit more background about yourself and how you got into OCR racing, and also what the hell it was like growing up in Siberia.
Well, growing up in Siberia was, you know, your typical, you know, you wake up in a freezing cold, you walk through the snow 10 miles barefoot to school, none of that really happened. But people actually think that it has. I'm regularly asked if there are, you know, bears and wolves walking down the city streets in my hometown. But I'm from the third largest city in Russia. It's actually the city third in size after St. Petersburg. So it's Moscow, St. Petersburg, and then my city. It's Novosibirsk, capital of Siberia.
Pronounce that.
Well, you've had enough trouble with my last name, and I think you did a fantastic job. Oh, so I think you kind of done with the Russian pronunciation for this podcast. But I think it was a fairly typical childhood, as Russian childhoods are considered. I mean, I moved a lot just with having lived in Netherlands for a little bit and then immigrating to Canada. I ended up changing schools 6 times, and we ended up living in 3 different countries and learning to speak 3 different languages throughout. So some of those transitions weren't easy, but they all landed me where I am today. And I think I came out the other end being pretty resilient. And that's one of the things I definitely pride myself on, and being able to swim and not sink, whatever comes up. And I think that's where the sport comes in really well too, because with obstacle racing and extreme endurance, that ability, that skill comes in quite handy, because you never quite know what you're going to get. Absolutely. And I know some folks actually have a lot of trouble with that sport. Like if you come from the background of strict road racing or maybe triathlons, disciplines that are much more disciplined and predictable, you know exactly how long distances are and how long transitions are. Something like obstacle racing can be super tough because it can be unpredictable. You never know exactly how long the course is or what obstacles are going to be in your way. So I love it.
Definitely. Absolutely. Like I said, you are a badass. So I've done a few obstacle course races myself. Nowhere near as many as you, but like you, I'm a big fan. I did the first Tough Mudder when it came over to the UK. And I did I think this was like the original obstacle course race, at least in this country. It's called Tough Guy. It's at the end of
January. Absolutely.
Have you heard of Tough Guy?
Of course. Tough Guy is a mecca.
Have you done Tough
for
Guy?
Any obstacle racer. I was actually supposed to do this year, and I was off running injured. So I was incredibly bummed because there's been rumors that this past year was the last year that they've done it, but I'm still keeping an eye out and keeping my hopes up.
You know, it's been going since, oh God, what, the early 90s, I doubt.
The 80s, it's been a while.
It's been a long, long time. My dad did it twice back in the mid to early 90s, and I was like, right, well, if dad's done it, I've got to do it. I've definitely got to do it.
How did you make out? Because you got to be pretty good with the cold, which I'm not at all.
I was not very good with the cold whatsoever, I have to say. I found it. It was the toughest OCR I've done, without a shadow of a doubt, because there's, for people who don't know the Tough Guy, it's winter. Well, you can do a nettle warrior, a summer race. I'd never do that. That's crazy. I hate nettles. But it's winter race, tons of water, literally, you know, 100 meters from the start. You're straight in water and mud. And yeah, it's the coldest I think I've ever been. I got cramp numerous times, couldn't feel my hands. Yeah, I think I nearly cried at the end when I saw I had to swim like 200 meters through water, up a hill, down a hill, back into water. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. So
that sounds like Tough Guy. It's a tough race, and the cold is probably the biggest obstacle in that race. 100%. So to say that you finished it, it's a pretty awesome achievement. I think with Tough Guy, finishing Tough Guy is as big of an achievement as you can hope for. That's amazing. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much. You're 100%. The cold is definitely the toughest bit, because the obstacles they're not that bad. They've been there for years. You know, climbing over stuff, and there's a few big hills and in and out of some pits. It's fine. But when you get really cold and you cannot use your hands anymore, then swinging across ropes and monkey bars and stuff becomes pretty impossible. You just end up back in the water. What's been your toughest race?
Oh, such a good question, and such a difficult one to answer. Just I think because there have been so many toughest races for me. I actually wrote a blog post a few years ago in response to someone's comment, because somebody heard that I was doing a 5K road race on the weekend, and they said, "Oh, well, just a 5K. Well, that's a piece of cake for you." And I said, no, it's my most hated distance, because it is so difficult. Yeah. Because at a 5K, it's a flat course. There are no obstacles. There is no excuse but to go balls to the wall. So you're going all out, right? And you feel like you're going to throw up the entire time. So it's incredibly hard. So I would say one of my toughest races has probably been some of my faster 5K races because they're so intense, just physically. Like, you have to dip into that suffering and stay there until you're done. Yeah. And then other races have been incredibly tough because they've been incredibly long, or races where I haven't been in a good place psychologically. Some races were really difficult because you didn't know what to expect, and that can be hard because you're kind of out of control. Like, so with a typical race, the faster you run, the faster you're done, because you know that there is only 3 miles or 10 miles. So the faster you can cover that distance, the faster it ends. With some of the events that I've done, they're more time-based. Yeah. So you could be out there for 48 hours. So it doesn't really matter what you do in those 48 hours. It's not done until it's done. And you can't do anything to make it pass any faster. It's been great few years of learning, for sure.
Yeah. Are you possibly talking about the Canadian death race there with the 48-hour one, or is that even longer? Because you've done the death race, right?
It's funny, I've done a couple. There are a couple of events out there with death race in the title, which by definition, you know, you throw the word death in the title and it will immediately scare off a bunch of people. Yep. And attract, right, a bunch of crazies, right? So it's like, oh, that sounds good. I think a friend of mine actually decided that he wanted to do all the races with the word death in it. So the Spartan death race, so, yeah, is the one.
The original one by Joe DeSena.
The original one by Joe, yeah. So the original one by Joe DeSena is no longer around. It's been retired a few years ago, but it's been running for a number of years in Killington, Vermont, around the Killington-Pittsfield area. And that race was actually super difficult because the time was not really known either. So everyone knew that once you're out there, you'll be out there for a while, yeah, but it could last 40 hours, it could last 67 hours. It could, you knew you'd be there for the weekend, but yeah, exactly when you'd be done and what you would have to do in between was a complete unknown. Yeah. So that was incredibly difficult, I think, for some folks. I know for me, it was because of that uncertainty. I've always struggled a bit, kind of turning my mind off and focusing on just, you know, one step at a time. And I actually found that boredom was a really big factor for me, kind of knowing that you're here for the long haul and you are doing some really mind-numbing tasks for hours on end, whether it's carrying a heavy stone with you through the woods, or whether it's chopping 200 pounds of wood and then stacking that wood through the, you know, yeah, midnight hours, barely functioning. Yeah, so
this is the crazy stuff you have to do on the death race. It's absolutely mental. I spoke to Joe a year or so back on another podcast, and he was describing some of the mental things he has people do. And it's like, yeah, we're not going to stop the race until, you know, 3/4 of the competitors drop out. We're just going to keep going.
Yeah. And I think him and the organizers have enjoyed putting together some of those tasks quite a bit and kind of see who's the creative genius behind all the evil tasks they have, yeah, participants do. So, yeah. And it was very different year to year as well, which is what I think appealed to a lot of people too. Some of the other events with the word death in it, the Great Canadian Death Race has been around for a while, and it's a complete 180 from the Spartan Death Race because it's actually a pure ultra running race through, okay, the Canadian Rockies. Mm-hmm. And it includes, it's 125K in length, and it includes 3 mountain summits.
Wow.
So it's an ultra with a completion rate, I think, of less than 30%. Most people do it as a relay, but some people do it solo. And I, you know, think I have some hopes of maybe doing it solo one day. But a couple of years ago, I did it with a partner. So we each did about 60K. And it was just a gorgeous, gorgeous race with incredible views. And each leg is different. It just feels like you're in 3, 4, 5 different countries, climate zones, completely different scenery. So that was amazing.
Wow, that does sound amazing. And your nickname is Solo, so surely you have to do it solo at some point.
Kind of, because the solo racers at the death race, everybody knows them from the bibs. They have a different color bibs. Oh, and okay. What's really cool is when the solo racers emerge at leg transitions, all the spectators and volunteers cheer them on, and they all scream, "Go solo, solo, go!" And that to me was just such a weird experience, because at every transition there'd be these really haggard looking racers coming through, and everybody was yelling my name. I wasn't sure why. So yeah, I think that would be super cool.
That would be amazing. Just like, yeah, everyone's yelling for me. Woo!
That's right. Yeah.
So obviously you are mentally tough. You have to be to do what you do as a competitive OCR racer. How did you develop that mental toughness?
I think it's gradual progression, and it's such a boring answer. And I realize that it's almost disappointing, right?
But it could be boring if you try, Kate.
Well, you just wait. Some people ask, like I've heard that question being asked before, like, how do you get into these crazy races? And I think most people, they kind of raise an eyebrow when I tell them that I signed up for a road 5K. But that's exactly what happened. I was curious about doing a race. So I signed up for a road 5K and I did it. And I still remember being in kind of that mindset, getting ready for a 5K. I was relatively fit, but I wasn't really doing anything super crazy. I think I was doing like elliptical or cardio 2 times a week. So I think fairly typical for someone in their early to mid 20s. I remember before the race, I went out a couple of times wanting to cover 5K just in case, because I was like, I think I'll be okay, but I just want to make sure I can do it. And I would cover, run around a couple of blocks around where I lived just to make sure that when I show up on race day, I can definitely finish the 5. Yeah. And then finishing the 5 and thinking to myself, my God, I wonder if I could do 10. And the half marathon was so far away. It just seemed like such a huge jump and such a long distance. And I'm not even talking about a marathon, like 26 miles or 42.2 kilometers just sounded absolutely inhuman to me. It's just like, I can't believe there are people out there running for 4 or 5 hours.
I totally agree.
So there you go, right? So I still remember all those points, right? So when now people find my bucket list online and they say, oh my God, you've done these crazy things and these crazy races, I actually encourage them to scroll up and down, because you see the items that have been crossed off. And to run a 10K was on my bucket list, and to run half marathon has been on my bucket list. And they've just all been crossed off one by one, by one, by one, by one. So slowly, gradual progression. And I started with a Spartan Sprint, which is the shortest race. It's, I think, like half the length of Tough Mudder. And then I did a longer Spartan and a longer Spartan and a longer Spartan. And I think that all culminated in, you know, a 56-hour Spartan, which was the Spartan death race.
Nice. So we will come back to your bucket list. I mentioned it in the introduction, and I had a quick read through it. It's incredible. It goes on for like pages and pages and pages. But,
I've been busy.
You obviously have, and there's so much more for you to do, which is fantastic. But what's been we've talked about your toughest race. What's been your toughest challenge? And that could be set in life, in training, or indeed in racing.
My toughest challenge, I think my toughest challenge has been probably acknowledging vulnerability and asking for help. And also learning to work with the body I have today and not the body I had yesterday or a week ago. Or a month ago. And I think there are a couple of experiences sort of tied into that. Just I think most athletes, most racers get injured eventually, whether it's through overuse or whether just through an unfortunate mishap on the race course. And especially with obstacle racing and extreme racing, the risk of those injuries tends to be higher. But when you do get injured, everything changes. And if you've found a lot of joy and meaning in training and running in that very particular way, right? Kind of being used to able to just go out for a 2-hour run and enjoy the trail on the weekend, and then all of a sudden not being able to do that. I think that has been challenging, but I think it also pushed me in very cool ways to not only find ways to train around an injury, because now I really pride myself on being able to train around pretty much anything, to finding ways to move. But I think it's also been incredibly helpful in my work with clients, because all of them are facing very unique challenges. And I think the more challenges we go through just as human beings, the more we're able to relate to other people's suffering, whether that comes from an injury or whether that comes from immigration or, you know, having a difficult relationship with the parent, right? Or having a child or whatever that may be. So this is, I think, part of the reason why I've really loved this idea of a bucket list, because to me, it just seems like I'm going through life accumulating these incredible experiences. And the more experiences I have, the more I'm able to relate to other people, because there's always this connection that I can find. Because it's like, oh, well, you're from Paris. I've been to Paris and I loved this and this, right? Like, there's always something, whether it's a race or a travel, or, you know, we both have cats, or we both love coffee. So, and I love finding that connection. Like, what do we share? What do we have in common? Where are we on the same wavelength? And where are we on very different wavelengths? Because that allows for opportunity for growth and for learning as well, for some bashing of heads as well.
Fantastic. How long were you out injured for?
A couple of injuries. I mean, and I've never been completely out, because like I said, I've managed to train around them. But with some of the injuries, they've been very much present for as long as 6 to 8 months. And I just found different things to do. And this is how I've discovered different sports as well, because if my upper body was injured, I've injured a wrist a number of years back, actually just training leading up to the Spartan Death Race. So that was quite stressful. But I knew that I could no longer do, you know, push-ups or pull-ups for a while. And I focused all of my efforts on running and lower back, like lower body work. Similarly to, you know, when I injured my ankle, I could no longer run, but I could still do weightlifting or things that are much more controlled, kind of being in that space in the gym, being able to control the weight. So all of that, I think, made me much more creative when it comes to physical movement.
Yeah. Fantastic. I think that's an awesome little golden nugget of advice there for everyone out there listening, is you can train around your injuries, guys. So don't just stop. Right. You've mentioned it a couple of times, your bucket list. Talk to me a little bit more about this bucket list. Like I said, it's pages long on your website. How did you start with this? When did this start? And do you think having a bucket list has made you more determined and adventurous to go out there and live life?
So the bucket list started, I think I must have been in my late teens, which is a little crazy, because I think the bucket list is literally like the longest thing I have continuously worked on ever. Because I'm now like approaching my mid-30s. So I think like in a couple of years, I'll be able to say, I've been working on this bucket list for 20 years, which will be mind blowing. So somewhere, I think in high school, it's just noticing myself having conversations with other people. And whenever I would hear something cool, I would say, oh my God, that sounds great. I'm going to put it on my bucket list. And eventually I realized that I kept saying it, yet there was never a bucket list in existence. And in my experience, that's actually quite common. Like, many of us use that expression as like, I've always wanted to insert the blank, but we've never really taken the time to capture those ideas, to write them down. Yeah. So I decided to write down those ideas, and it was actually really cool, because I think I started out with a fairly short list. It was maybe 10 or 15 items, but I now had a place to put them all. Like, I had a depository. So whenever I heard people now talk about amazing things, I knew to note it down. And I think that's how it grew. So what you see is a result of a lot of creative stealing from amazing people I've encountered along the way.
That's the best way to go, steal from the best, you know?
Absolutely. And now from what I hear, a lot of people have been stealing from my bucket list. Okay. And that is like the biggest compliment you can give to a bucket lister, right? It's like, oh my God, I love that. I'm going to put it on mine. It's like, you can have it. Enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's how it came to be.
I love that. What's next to tick off?
What is next to tick off? Oh, that's a good one. Well, to shave my head was on my bucket list for a very long time, very long time. And in addition to, you know, being the queen of bucket list, I'm actually also the queen of loopholes. I'm a big fan of creative interpretations, right? Because it's my freaking list. Absolutely. So I can do whatever Absolutely. I want with it. So I think it was in December, so just a few months ago, when it struck me that nowhere on my list it said that I had to shave my whole head. So, see, a loophole. So I headed down to a salon and I got one of those, like, you know, really funky looking undercut haircuts. And that included shaving half of my head. So that crossed off a bucket list item. Of course, now I'm in an ugly stage of growing out an undercut because now half of my head is long and the half of my hair is this like really tufty pieces. But I'm thinking that I'm going to take advantage of it and build that into one of my next bucket list items. So there's been a really silly one and it's been on there forever. And I feel like now that I'm going to say it out loud, I'm actually committing to it, which is so crazy. So most of you guys will remember the movie Matrix.
Yes.
I think it was from like the early 2000s or like maybe late 90s with, what's his name? That's right.
The Wachowskis is how you pronounce it, I think.
One of the main characters there, the female character, is Trinity. And she's that badass chick and, you know, these dark sunglasses, riding a motorcycle covered in leather or pleather or whatever that outfit was made of. So I've had this idea that I wanted to dress up as her for Halloween for the longest time. And I don't, like, if I decide on something, I go like full in all the way. So I thought that when I decide to dress up as her, I'm actually going to dye my hair black and I'm going to get her haircut. So that's, I think, what I'm going to turn my undercut in. I'm going to bring the pictures of Trinity to the salon and say, do this.
Fantastic. That'll be awesome. I can't wait to, please share them on Instagram so we can.
Oh, absolutely. I should. Yeah. I've already ordered, and this is so embarrassing. I've ordered a Trinity costume off eBay probably 2 years ago and did not have the guts to dress up. So it's somewhere there tucked away. My best friend's been giving me a hard time because she knows I've been at it for years. She's like, just do it already. So, and now I've publicly said it. So I think it's happening, guys.
So now you committed. Now, excellent. Well, we all very much look forward to seeing those photos on Instagram. Right. Let's talk a little bit about training. I think the whole obstacle course racing philosophy fits really well with the everyday athlete philosophy. You know, we're all about health and longevity and adventure, training for purpose, you know, that whole thing. That's the OCR lifestyle. And, you know, for races like that, you know, you need strength, endurance, power, a bit of speed, balance, bit of agility for all the obstacles. How do you train for those qualities?
I've thought a lot about sort of what the best training is for obstacle racing because it's a new sport. So we don't really have as much experience as we have with a lot of other sports that have been around for much, much longer. But we know what skills are involved. And when it comes to the different components, you know, we can look at the physical training. We can also look at the mental training because oftentimes there is quite a large psychological piece to these races. And you, as somebody that has done Tough Mudder, can probably attest to that.
Yep.
Tough Mudder is one of the events that really prides itself on tapping into common fears and allowing people to conquer those fears or not out on the race course, whether it's heights or cold water or even electricity. With physical training, the electricity.
Oh my word! I got electrocuted about 10 times. I was vibrating for about 2 miles after that.
It's crazy, isn't it? The first time I did it, I remember I was in such shock, pun intended. Yeah. But I think I wasn't expecting how strong it was going to be, right? Because I was like, well, it is. Yeah. So I'm with you there. With physical training, I kind of view two main components to the training. And one is the cardiovascular endurance, and the other one is just the muscular strength. And if you were to look at the two, cardiovascular endurance is definitely king, because especially for longer races, runners that maybe even lack strength would still do better than strong folks that lack cardio. And you see that quite a bit. You see a lot of like really strong muscular guys at these races that just go gung ho for the first 500 meters and then completely sizzle out because they're often used to these really high intensity, super short workouts. Yep. And they just don't have the endurance that's required to kind of keep them going. So I know in little bit of that gleeful nature, I quite enjoy picking them off course as I pass them, because in the beginning, they all like just run out from the gate, right? And I think to myself, well, I'm probably going to see you guys in about 20 minutes. And I happen to. So the cardio is definitely it. And I mean, I usually recommend, like when talking to folks that are taking on these events, to be able to run at least the distance of the race, knowing that whatever the distance is, it will probably take you much longer than just running it, because you will be dealing with obstacles, which tend to slow you down quite a bit, as it turns out. Just a tiny bit. I think as any obstacle racer has experienced, like when you are in a super long race and you know you only have like a mile or two to go and you're almost there, and then you turn a corner and you realize that the next like half a mile is a super heavy bucket carry. So you could be out there, like you're almost done, but you're so far away.
Yeah, and that's when the mental toughness kicks in, isn't it? It's like, oh man, I thought I was nearly there. Now I've got to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that mental toughness, I think it almost can be beneficial to consider what kind of obstacles you may encounter, because I think most of us know what causes trouble, right? Like, so I'm super not a big fan of tight spaces. I'm somewhat claustrophobic. So for me, any sort of crawling through tight spaces is always super freaky. Yeah. And I think actually in my first Tough Mudder, we did it as a team. And I was at the front running and cheering everybody on, except when we hit an obstacle where we had to crawl through this tight thing. So my whole team, they climbed through and they kept running. And I said, oh, wait, where's Solo? And they looked around and Solo was before that obstacle, breathing really deeply as I'm bent over my knees, right? Like my hands on my knees, just trying to calm myself down before going into this tiny, tight hole. Yeah. So I think that was a little unexpected for them. So like, Solo, you okay? You were just fine a second ago. But it was that beauty of, no, you can have the fitness, you can have the endurance and the strength, and none of that was an issue, except you hit that one thing. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, your fitness flies out of the window, because now you're facing something very different. You're facing a fear. In that case, a very irrational fear, because I mean, I knew I was not going to be buried underground forever, even though it felt like it at the time. And that's a tough one. So overcoming that is super cool.
Definitely. Did you not add any of that into your training, crawling through tight spaces now?
No. I don't think I'm that mentally tough. So I still manage the tight spaces on a case-by-case basis when I absolutely have to. Although I did mention that being vulnerable and asking for help is one of kind of the things that I've tried to embrace and get better at. So I've gotten really good at asking fellow racers to get me through those obstacles. So the way I got through that first one, I've asked two of the guys on the team, and I had the first one go in front of me, and I held on to his ankle, and the other one was right behind me, and he sort of held on to mine. So I knew that worst case scenario, they're just going to drag me out. Even if I pass out, I was still going to make it out of there. So they were true gentlemen.
Fantastic. I think that's another top tip right there. Do ask for help on these races, because I went with a couple of friends. We all lost each other right at the start. Well, actually, one of my friends just bombed off and left us for dead. And yeah, he was gone. He was gone. I knew he was going to do it, but I was like, oh, thanks, mate. Yeah, he's gone. So I ended up running around with two complete strangers. We made friends, you know, around the course. We were ended up running together. And without their help, I wouldn't have made it around and over some of the obstacles, because I'm short and tiny. I never would have been able to get over some of those walls. So thank you guys for that. So, yep, definitely ask for help. And I also I'd never actually run 12 and a bit miles in my life. So so heed what Kate says, try and run the distance before you do the course. Any other top tips before we move on from OCR racing?
Well, I think the one thing I would say is that when you train, don't just run. Because again, the sort of the other piece, right, to getting used to the fact that your race will be interrupted all the time by hills and obstacles, and actually knowing what that feels like, because especially for runners, it can be a bit of a shock to, you know, because they're used to settling into a pace and then staying there. And it's very different when you're settling into a pace, then all of a sudden you have to jump over a wall and then you have to keep running because your heart rate just spikes, right? So I'm kind of learning to maneuver your body weight up over and around various barriers, whether it's jumping over rocks or crawling on the ground or climbing trees, or can be really helpful. And I love trail running for that, just because it presents an obstacle in itself with the technical terrain and plenty of things to jump over. And of course, you can always pick up a log for a mile or two, carry that on your shoulder, and then drop it off and keep running.
Absolutely. Are you what does your current training regime look like? Are you training for anything in particular at the moment?
So the current training regime is actually quite a bit different. So I've gotten into Olympic weightlifting a little bit more in the last year, and to participate in an Olympic lifting competition is, of course, on the bucket list. So I have my eye out for that. But there are a couple of races that I am excited about this year. So the Obstacle Racing World Championships is probably one of the best events in the industry. Awesome. And it's happening in Ontario, Canada for the second year in a row. And I think this will be their last year in North America for a bit. So I'm hoping to be there. And yeah, other than that, there's running and Olympic weightlifting. That's probably what I do most of right now.
Fantastic. Well, good luck in the race. Come on, win it for us, Kate. You got to win it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because the field has been becoming more and more competitive as the sport grows. And it's just been really cool to watch that because starting out in 2010 and 2011, it was this fringe sport. So it wasn't too difficult to show up on a race circuit, and being relatively fast and relatively strong often end up on podium. And now we see athletes from various sports attracted to this sport because, again, the money's starting to increase for the first, second, and third prizes. There's definitely more interest from the media. The Spartan Race has just recently done their first live coverage of an event, which is something that we've been hoping for years. So it's been a direct live streaming, and I think they've had over 40,000 people watching it on Facebook Live alone. So that was just super cool. So I'm excited to see where the sport goes as it gets bigger and you see these different offshoots into various directions. Some go longer, some just go more niche, some start traveling to different countries and incorporating different themes. So it's all super exciting.
Cool. That sounds great. Well, I hope they screen the World Championships. I'll be tuning into that. Well, not only are you an obstacle course racer. Sorry. Not only are you.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm going to. Yeah, definitely enjoy it. I'll be looking out for you and screaming solo from my couch. not only are you an obstacle course racer and a prolific blogger, but you're also a coach with Precision Nutrition. In case any of our listeners have not heard of Precision Nutrition and what they do, could you just give us a brief introduction and what you do as a coach for them?
Yeah, so Precision Nutrition is the world's largest online nutrition coaching company. So we have now coached over 50,000 clients over the last, I think, 10 or so years. And as a coach, I work with clients for a duration of a year. So our clients, they commit for 12 months and they go through the coaching program that includes a behavioral component. It includes nutrition habits and detailed workouts for that year to achieve whatever their health goals are. I mean, one of the company's taglines is eat, move, and live better. So we have clients that come to lose weight, to gain weight, gain muscle, go off medication, just to learn to be more consistent with their habits throughout their life. So just kind of working with everyday people to help them live their lives better. So it's really rewarding in that sense.
I bet. And as you say, Precision Nutrition have helped so many people. It's absolutely fantastic. And as you said, it's not just about weight loss. It's all, you know, body composition. So muscle gain, and you cover the whole gambit. And you said you do behavioral change. Part of that is motivational interviewing. Can you just talk a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, motivational interviewing is an approach that kind of started up in the field of psychology, and I think organizational psych as well. And it's been used for anything now from weight management to smoking cessation. And it's essentially a counseling approach that focuses on the client rather than the coach or the expert, especially in our field and health and fitness industry. We are often used to expect a certain amount of knowledge, expertise from the coaches, as we should. However, what that often turns into is the expert-client relationship, where the client expects their coach to tell them what to do, to tell them what they're doing right, to tell them what they're doing wrong, and kind of have these instructions to follow. So the motivational approach takes kind of a 180 from that, because it's a client-centered approach. So some of the assumptions of the approach are that clients are experts on ourselves, because you are the only one who lives in your body. So I can't possibly know what that's like. Yeah. You probably already have the answers and the solutions to most obstacles and challenges you're facing. So now my job as a coach is not to tell you what to do, but rather help you, assist you in figuring out what some of the solutions that may work for you are, but also how to implement them into your life. And I think that's a really key difference there between the role of a coach and the role of an expert. Because for the most part, people don't need to be told how to eat better. Most of us know that vegetables are good, and French fries and donuts are probably not so much, right? I haven't really met a client for whom that was brand new information. So I think from that sense, we health fitness professionals can come across as a little bit condescending sometimes, yeah. Right? It's like, well, eat more vegetables. Like, really, Sherlock? Thank you. I've never heard this before. So I always remind my clients that my job is not to tell them, not to teach them some sort of new info. They already have that information. My job is to help them implement it into their life so they can actually stick to it.
Yeah, give them the power. I love it.
That's right.
Do any clients struggle with that when they first start out? Do they just say like, hey, I just please tell me what to do. I want to know what to do.
Absolutely. I think many clients come in with an expectation because this is the expectation we set as an industry. So, and I think there are plenty of coaches and trainers and companies out there that would love nothing more than to tell you what to do. But because Precision Nutrition prides itself on being a research-driven company, we really try to focus on what works and what we know from research, but also from experience, both our own personal experience as just humans living in bodies, but also seeing what works for our clients, is that telling others what to do is not exactly the best way to get them to change. And if you've ever tried to change, you know, your girlfriend or boyfriend, you probably know that, right? So it's
occasionally in the past, you know,
just a tiny bit. Yeah, it tends to not end well. So I think it can be up to a coach to decide what role you are willing to play. And I think it's definitely a discussion that takes place early on. And most of our clients come to Precision Nutrition for that reason, because they know that the approach is different. And they've already tried the other approach, yeah, and it didn't work for them. And they want something that works.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you incorporate habits into that. How does that work? Do clients get to choose their own habits, go at their own pace?
Clients get to choose some of their own habits. For the most part, we do have a curriculum that they follow that is timed over the course of the year. So we introduce new nutritional habits every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So for the 2 weeks, the clients will focus exclusively on that habit. And then the habits build on each other. So as we introduce new habits, we move the previous habits to a bit of a back burner and bring the new focus on the new habit, all the while building our stack of the good habits that we have in our pocket. So it's a very progressive change over the course of the year. And it can feel slow at times, but that's what we're finding to be the best approach, because that's the approach that makes people feel as if they can stick to it, unlike your typical January 1st resolution approach, where you decide to eat better and work out and meditate and quit smoking all starting tomorrow.
And that usually lasts. And do a marathon. You're forgetting all these things.
All those things. That's right. And go to church and call my mom. Absolutely. Right? Like it's so that usually lasts, in my experience, about 4.5 days.
Yeah.
And then you just feel really bummed out about yourself and you feel like a failure. And it just seems that we have enough people feeling like a failure. That's not really my goal as a coach. I actually enjoy making people feel like a success. And the more we feel like a success, the more we can build on that. And if you're used to succeeding, you can succeed more because you've done it in the past.
Absolutely. I love that. Layer upon layer. Fantastic. So if someone's struggling getting their nutrition on point, what would be your top tips?
Top tips for someone struggling with nutrition habits. I would say probably a couple of big ones are shrink the change. This is one approach that we talk about within PN, within Precision Nutrition. So if you're struggling with a particular nutritional approach, more often than not, it's not that you are doing something wrong or you are a failure. More often than not, it's simply that the change you chose is too big for now. And if you scale it back, if you make it smaller, all of a sudden it's doable. So the way I usually like to do it with clients is we keep shrinking the change until it almost seems too small. So when we talk about like frequency of workouts and they want to work out 6 days a week, or if they want to increase the number of servings of vegetables they have, ideally one day they want to work their way up to 6, 7, or 8 servings of vegetables a day, but it just feels insurmountable now. It feels like it's too big and they feel overwhelmed by that. So the solution would be to aim for 6 or 5 or 4 or 1.
Yeah.
And we keep shrinking that change. I laugh because I usually listen for the client to make the sound when we talk. And they make the sound
when
it sounds
you say
like
a number. When you go
to when I say a number, yeah. So they make the sound and it sounds like this. They go, it just like sounds like really? And it is just like, what, that's it? One serving of vegetables a day, that's it. And I say, perfect. I just heard you make the sound. So that's what we're gonna go for. It's so easy, it's ridiculous. There's no way you can't not do that. Yeah. So, and this again going back to building a habit of success, because if you can do this super duper easy thing for a week or two, then we can amp it up just a tiny bit and go to 1.5 servings of vegetables or two, and you already have a week of succeeding under your belt, rather than having a week or two or a decade of years failure under your belt. And that's often people's common experience, where they may have been trying to do something for many years and continue to fail because they keep setting up these really, really big, lofty goals. Yeah. And it goes back to the gradual progression, because I don't think I would have ever been able to participate in the great Canadian death race right out of the gates. Instead, I signed up for a road 5K and I was super happy to finish it.
Fantastic. Yeah, there you go, guys. Another awesome bit of advice. Shrink your goals, start small, and build from there. Kate, unfortunately, we are pretty much bang out of time, which is terrible because I've absolutely loving chatting with you. Before you go, what's your favorite food?
Oh, goodness, my favorite food. Well, I'm married to an Italian, so I think I have to say his homemade pizza with anchovies. He doesn't make it very often because it takes forever. Well, he doesn't, but in my mind, it takes forever because I have to walk around and smell it all day with the dough rising and the whole thing. But I have to say, when he makes it, it's heavenly. So that's probably it.
It's my tea time over here. I'm absolutely starving now. You're making me so hungry. I think I'm gonna go with you on the Italian theme. I'm stuck between either a steak or spag bol. I absolutely love those.
Making me hungry now.
Kate, it's been absolutely fantastic chatting with you. Thank you so much, guys. If you want to know more about Kate, get to www.soloviova.com. That's SOLOVIEVA. .com. Thank you so much, Kate, and thank you for listening in. Until next time. Ah, there we go. I really hope you all enjoyed that. Time to get working on those bucket lists, I think. Me and Kate probably could have chatted on for about another hour. We had so much to talk about, but obviously the podcast does need to have some sort of time limit. And Kate, I just want to say a huge thank you for probably the nicest and most complimentary email I've ever had from a podcast guest. I really, really appreciate it. Hope you've done my review. Thank you very much. In next week's show, I speak to Dr. Greg Lehman, a physiotherapist, chiropractor, and strength and conditioning specialist treating musculoskeletal disorders within a biopsychosocial model. So